The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
I'd now like to introduce our demonstrator tonight, who really needs no introduction at all, Kate Brax. Kate's the mother of three. She was previously a school teacher and lives in Orange, which is in the central west of New South Wales. Kate entered the third series of MasterChef in 2011, and she won! She beat Michael Walden in front of an estimated 2.7 million viewers around Australia. Since winning the series...
Who saw the finale?
Anyone here see the finale?
Oh,
yeah. there's a few... Actually, I won't ask how many were going for Kate or was going for Kate. But anyway, since winning the... We'll talk a bit more about what's happened after MasterChef later, but since winning the series, Kate's released a cookbook. She has a regular country cook column in MasterChef Australia. She cooks regularly with local chefs and is a popular personality at food festivals and events nationally. She's also a Christian believer, and her comments surrounding the Dalai Lama created news headlines around the world. But more of that later. Please welcome Kate Brax.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be here. So we're going to do quite a bit of cooking tonight. We're going to cook a couple of desserts. Desserts are what I say are my first love in the cooking world. So I actually love any cooking. But as a child, and for those of you who have fussy children, this will be a real encouragement to you. I was an incredibly fussy eater. And my mother looks at me today and thinks, never would have guessed that you'd be doing what you're doing now. Because I was also incredibly shy. I was kind of one of those kids that hid behind my mother's skirt. Cooking for me started when I was about 8 years old. I remember being really bored one long summer holidays, and I said to Mum, I'm bored. And she said, well, I don't know, why don't you cook something? And I grew up in the 80s, the era of Peter Russell Clark and people like that. So what I decided to do was measure out all my little containers of everything, set it all up, and I was going to make this beautiful coffee cake using, you know, nothing but the best instant coffee. And I set it all up, and I spent pretty much, I think, the entire day talking to the wall as if I was on television doing this, you know, cooking class. And at the end of it, I had this rather gaudy-looking cake with piped icing, and I'm sure it was really unattractive. But, of course, my family gushed over it and said, oh, aren't you clever, isn't that wonderful? And I say that that's the day that I fell in love with cooking. It was always, as a child, it was always sweet food. Didn't really actually start cooking much in the way of savoury in terms of just for the joy of it until we moved to Orange, which was 6 years ago. So my husband and I grew up in Sydney, and then we moved to Orange, which is 4 hours west of Sydney, and it's a really big foodie, it's a big food bowl for New South Wales. So we have an enormous amount of produce grown right on our doorstep. And so when we landed in Orange, I was absolutely astounded with the gorgeous produce that we had and how easy it was to grow it in my own backyard. And so I really started exploring a lot more in terms of savoury cooking, and I think that's when I really became quite passionate about all sorts of cooking. But tonight we're going back to the first class. We're going to do two cooking demonstrations. Do you want me to get started on them, or do
Before we do that, just want to say, so before we get on to the first demonstration, so 2 years ago you won the first Master, you won one MasterChef, but can you just maybe give us a bit of a background before we do the cooking, why you entered MasterChef in the first place, and what happened there?
Okay, so it's a bit of a funny story. I didn't actually intend to sort of enter MasterChef. It just sort of happened. So let me share it with you. My husband is one of those men who just knows what's going on everywhere all the time. I have no idea how. He has this uncanny ability. And he came home from work one day as a primary school teacher, and he said, this was back before the first season of MasterChef, and he said, there's this new show coming. It's called MasterChef. It's all cooking. They've got a version of it in the UK. I think you should go on it. I said, you're not going on TV. That's ridiculous. But I went online, watched this version in the UK and thought, oh my goodness, that looks like so much fun. So I went online, filled out the application form. Of course, at this stage, nobody knew it was going to be the big show that it became. So I was thinking, I can go on it, have a bit of fun, come home, nobody will know. Anyway, so I filled out the application form, but the last question was, would you be willing to be away from your family for up to 4 months of filming? And my baby at the time was 18 months. And I thought, actually, no, I'm not willing to do that. So I shut it down, I didn't send it. You can imagine then that I watched it. I was a bit of an avid fan right from the beginning, and I watched all of season one and all of season two. I was the one that had the MasterChef party for the finale night. Everybody came round, and, you know, we all brought food. And then I saw an ad on TV at the end of season two saying that applications were open online for season three. I went online thinking, I wonder how this application form's changed, because it's this juggernaut now. So I went online, and it was an incredibly long application form, but it was one of those online versions where you had to fill in every field before it let you go to the next page. So, you know, over a course of a few days, I'd fill in a few more questions, because I was just interested to see what they were asking. And eventually got to the end and, you know, just send, because you finish the form, that's what you do, you press enter. And promptly forgot about it. And it was probably about a month later, I got a phone call to say, we'd like you to come for an audition. I said to my husband, I can't go on MasterChef, that's ridiculous. He said, Kate, we've been away from the kids and you get to see the inside workings of MasterChef. What are you thinking? And I thought, yep, good point. So off I went, did this audition, thinking I'll just have a bit of fun, see how all this show gets put together. And, did my audition for a few days and then headed back home thinking, okay, back down to normal life. And then I got a call saying, guess what? You made it into the top 50 of MasterChef. And I went, can I call you back? And I spent 48 hours in absolute agony thinking, do I do this or do I not do this? This is ridiculous. I can't just up and leave my life and go and do TV. And my husband was actually arguing all the reasons why I could. I was arguing all the reasons why I couldn't. I went and found a few good friends who I was sure would say to me, don't be ridiculous, but they said, go, we'll help Luke. And I kind of went, okay. And one of the funny things is that Luke actually did say to me, just go. It probably won't last all that long. It's not going to last. So now I can actually sort of blame him for the fact that life's rather unrecognisable. So off I went, and that's how it happened. And it was kind of a case of just take each week as it comes, because I was quite sure I would be there for a couple of weeks and go home. I didn't tell anybody in town, apart from those good friends that I asked. Nobody else knew. We just disappeared from swimming lessons. We disappeared from ballet lessons. We just disappeared because I thought, I'll be gone a couple of weeks. I'll be back. Nobody needs to know. Nobody ever watches the top 50 anyway. It's all okay. And, it kept going and going and going. But my husband is amazing, and he's the reason that I was able to stay there and do it. I had decided, I think one of the reasons it was difficult to decide to go was because I didn't want to go unless I was willing to go for as long as it lasted. I didn't want to take the spot that somebody else could have had and pull out. So towards the end, I started getting in elimination rounds, and I'd say to my husband, I think I'm going home now. No, I'm still here. He never once complained, though. He said, keep going, you're doing well, keep staying there, we're fine, don't worry about us. So he's been amazing in enabling me to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Kate, tell us more about your... So, you know, I mean, it was just really interesting there, just sitting here, just the smells that came from the dish that came. That's one of the things you don't get on television. What was it like in the MasterChef kitchen when all these smells were obviously going around and so on? Was that something that
It's a pretty crazy environment in there. And I remember walking onto the set the very first day, and I think I walked around the whole day with my mouth open. Just the numbers of people, the crew is huge. So when we were filming Top 50, the crew would have numbered about 90. So it was lots of people, lots of cameras, lots of sound, lots of noise, lots of flavours. It's a pretty incredible thing to watch. There are a few times I was standing on a balcony watching a challenge, and it's almost like, I don't know where to look, I don't want to miss anything. There's so much going on. It's action-packed, it's fast, it's furious, but it's fun once you get over the nerves. There were many days at the beginning where I was like, I think I'm about to be sick. Just purely from the nerves. But for me, the worst part was always waiting to hear what the challenge was going to be. Once we knew what the challenge was going to be, then I felt like there was something I could do about it. Okay, I might not come up with anything brilliant, but at least I could think. You know, I could start trying to plan. Whereas, for up until that point. You just think, I don't know what they're going to throw at us, what are they going to make us do today?
So maybe talk a bit more about that. So do you think you could have done something like this before MasterChef?
No, I've learned so much about food and cooking throughout the whole process of MasterChef. So when I entered, I was very much a cook who relied completely on recipes. And the first day, they issued us with the challenge, and I said to one of the producers, are we allowed to have recipes under the bench? And she said, no. Pardon? I was sure that the contestants had recipes under there. They don't. Unless you see them handing you them a recipe, they don't have a recipe. And so you go into major panic mode and think, oh my goodness, what am I going to make? But what it did to me was it forced me to trust my gut instinct, something that I wasn't willing to do to myself at home. And because, you know, it's not me having to go out and do the shopping to buy the food to replace it, it is a lot easier to just go, oh, well, I'll have a go, oh, it didn't work, I'll just go get some more for the pantry, you know, it's a bit easier. But it forced me to trust that, and it also forced me to start researching a lot more and trying to memorise things. And everybody tried to memorise a shortcrust pastry, a pizza dough, a pasta dough, you know, all those basic things, because you could build a dish around that. So in the early days, there were lots of failures. But as time goes, you start to see what works. And also, you've got to remember as well, you're not actually cooking in a kitchen. You're cooking in a set, like a kitchen set. So the equipment doesn't work always the same way. They're in different places. And the taps are actually on a pump system, so sometimes they run out halfway through a challenge. And you go, we need more water! And sometimes they go, we haven't got any! Ah! It's all very crazy. But, I learned an enormous amount about cooking. The other thing is, oh, I just realised that had fallen all the way down there. Oh, you can see me now. The other thing I realised was, what was I going to say? Cooking. Lost it. I think I've completely lost my train of thought.
Maybe we'll try a new train, perhaps. I've lost my train of thought now as well. So that's... But just in terms of your MasterChef experience and so on, and the coaching and so on that they received, and things you've learned, so yes. Did they provide much coaching and so on?
Yeah, so you see Masterclass, obviously. Now you're seeing an edited version of that. So outside of that, they're still teaching us more. So the cameras stop filming and they might say, oh, and then there's this, and then there's this, and then there's this. So there's always that talk. And there's a lot of question-answer time. So we could go up to the judges pretty much at any point and say, can I just ask you about this? How would that work with this work? And they, I mean, as long as it wasn't in the middle of a challenge, they wouldn't tell us in the middle of a challenge. We also did work experience. Before the MasterChef went to air, we were taken out to commercial kitchens in pairs, and we would do an entire day. So we generally worked 5 or 6 days a week and then did one day in a commercial kitchen, and I absolutely loved that. For me, that was really getting my hands dirty and seeing different techniques, seeing real chefs doing real things on mass quantity levels. You really do learn a lot that way. And also, I was really fortunate to be able to go to a lot of the reward lunches, and often the chefs came out and sat with us. And again, you saw snippets of it spliced in, but we got to sit there for a good couple of hours and we could pick their brains, which I did. You know, for me, I treated it like it was my sabbatical, because I knew Luke and the kids were at home giving up so much for me to be there. I never treated it as a holiday. For me, no, this was my chance to learn. This was my big chance to spend time doing something that I absolutely love and to learn as much as I possibly could. And you never know when it's going to end. You know, I kept thinking, I might go home next time. I've got to just make the most of this opportunity right now.
So maybe just to talk about leaving your family. Do you have 3 young children at home and you didn't get to see them a huge amount?
Yeah.
How was that?
That was definitely the toughest part of the whole process. And as I said at the beginning, I really did think I was going to be only away for a few weeks. And I still remember thinking, oh my goodness, what if I'm away for a whole month? I'm not sure if I could do that. In the end, I was away for 7 months. I know. And I actually signed a contract, but the contract said the winner and the runner-up will be away for 7 months. That's okay. That's not me. Oops. Let's just say I take my contracts a little more seriously now. So it was quite tough going. I was very fortunate in that they were very mindful of my children and their ages. And so they put in place a few things to help us. So on top of the 10-minute phone call that everybody had each week, I also had 2 Skype calls. So my husband and I used the Skype calls for the kids and the phone call for each other. And then I had visits from them. Every 2 to 3 weeks, Luke would bring the kids down. Did I say that before?
No.
So Luke would bring the kids down from Orange, and we would meet in a park, and we'd have lunch, and we would, you know, cuddle and play for a few hours. I did feel like I was on day release from prison. But it was good. It was worth it. And I found it really hard, actually, then saying goodbye. That was, for me, the hardest part was the constant saying goodbye. So every couple of weeks, they'd come down, they'd have cuddles. I remember we got into a little sister now. I'd put them into the car. I'd walk around the back of the car with my husband. And, he'd say, it's all right, you're going all right, get going. Okay, right now, see kids. Off they go. I'd cry again before I walked back into the house. And then everybody in the house go, how was it? That was great. Yeah, it was tough. It was really tough.
So it sounds like obviously a very emotional time in so many ways, particularly, I suppose, as you're progressing through the competition, getting kind of closer to the end.
And the further you get, you know, the longer you've been away from home, the harder it is. For me, it was interesting too, because Luke and I don't generally take big holidays. We sort of, you know, we might go to a friend's place somewhere or we go camping somewhere. But we decided that my extended family wanted to go up to Palm Cove in Queensland. Kids were going on a plane, very exciting. And this was the year that I was away on MasterChef. So we were talking about it, and we decided that if we went in June, that would give me enough time to be home, but still have enough time before having to go back to film all the finale. So the day approaches, and I'm still in. I'm thinking this holiday's coming. And I got off the phone the day that they were all leaving on this holiday. And I've been saying to the crew, I didn't think I'd be here. And they're like, yeah, sure. I was like, no, seriously. And I got off the phone. We were in the middle of an overnight challenge in the house. And I got off the phone from saying goodbye to them at the point of, I'm actually not going on this holiday. And I just cried and cried and cried. And one of the producers said, are you all right? What's wrong? I said, my family going on holiday. I'm supposed to be going on. They even had a ticket for me, booked a ticket just in case I got eliminated. And she said, oh, you really didn't think you were going to be in. No, I didn't think I was going to be in this long. There were moments like that that were really hard. And birthdays. I really found birthdays hard to be away for. And my daughter, actually, my 10-year-old, broke her arm and had to have surgery. And that was... either. But the crew were very understanding and particularly good with me. I had a very good relationship with them, and at any point, if I needed an extra phone call or if there was something going on, they were more than happy to make that happen. And in fact, the house coordinator used to say, you know, the 10-minute phone call, okay, come on, it's been half an hour. Other people need to phone. I can't. Yeah. So there were lots of things they did to make it easier.
Yeah. Well, obviously there's lots of emotions and so on going through, but also it seems that, certainly even from watching the show, there tends to be a sense of maybe a loss of perspective. It just seems like a real hothouse. Like, what was your take on the...
Was that
your experience as
it,
well?
It is a pretty intense environment because you're away from your family, you're away from your work, you're away from your home, you're away from your friends. You are completely absorbed in MasterChef life. You have no access to television, to free-to-air television, or to magazines, or newspapers, or anything like that. So you really actually are quite disconnected with what's happening on the outside. Again, prison talk. Anyway, so it is very easy to become very consumed with this being the most important thing in life. And for me, I think I went in thinking life is bigger than MasterChef. And I used to say that. Sometimes some of the contestants would get very distraught. I was around and say, okay, remember, life's bigger than MasterChef. Life's bigger than MasterChef. And I think the producers would go, oh, shush, stop. But for me, I had to keep telling myself, it's just food, it's just television. And you really have to sort of fight that because it can become all-consuming. And, you know, at the end of the day, that makes great TV, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, let me just move on to your Wikipedia entry. I'm not sure if anyone's ever looked up Kate's Wikipedia. I don't think you realised you had a Wikipedia entry, but it says on it, it refers to your refusal to call the Dalai Lama your holiness. You said that your belief is that God is the only one that is perfectly holy. I mean,
yeah.
Are you able to share? Because that was a bit of a news item when it happened.
Look, it was really funny because I didn't really know what was going on outside. As I said, there was no TV, there was no newspapers, and my husband forgot to tell me. So what happened with the Dalai Lama? We have one of those seasons where it just seemed to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then they tell us we're cooking for the Dalai Lama. And we went, that is ridiculous. I still would love to have been privy to that conversation where they ring up his office and say, just wondering if the Dalai Lama would like to come and cook on come and be on MasterChef. I just can't imagine what his response would be. Anyway, he obviously said yes.
Maybe he's a big fan.
Yes, maybe. So in this particular challenge, because of his, I guess because of who he is and the magnitude of the stuff that happens around him, we actually found out about the challenge and then had a meeting about how to deal with the Dalai Lama. And one of the things that came up in that meeting was that the proper way to refer to him was as Your Holiness. Now, because I'm a Christian, I do have a problem with that, because the Bible teaches me that holiness means perfectly right with God. And the only person who has ever walked the earth who is perfectly right with God is Jesus. So therefore, you're not holy, I'm not holy, and as lovely as the Dalai Lama is, he's not holy by the Bible's definition and therefore by my definition. So in this meeting, I just asked whether... I asked his representative, because I was pretty aware that I didn't want to be offensive, and so I just said to her, look, as a Christian, I feel uncomfortable calling him Your Holiness, but I do really want to show him respect. Is there something else I could call him that would be just as respectful? And she answered very quickly, and she said, oh yeah, you could call him Dalai Lama, he wouldn't mind at all. So I went into that challenge not thinking twice about putting down my dish saying Dalai Lama when everybody else was saying Your Holiness. We did have a journalist on set that day, which was very rare, but I think, again, because of the magnitude of the situation, she was there, and she interviewed everybody about their experience. And obviously she picked up on the fact that I called him Dalai Lama as opposed to Your Holiness, and so she asked me about it, and I told her. That obviously then made the story, which then became bigger news. But as I said, I had no idea that that was going on. It was quite funny. When Michael and I, at the end, we were actually moved out of the house into a unit because, you know, two people don't really need a mansion. And so they moved us into a unit so they could prepare the house for other things. And in our rooms, there was a television each. And our house coordinator said, I won't tell if you don't tell. We hadn't had TV for months. We're like, okay. So I was sitting on the phone one night talking to Luke, and I flicked the TV on and Can of Worms came up. And there was this question, did Kate Brax do the right thing by not calling the Dalai Lama Your Holiness? And I was like, oh, I'll call you back. It was absolutely gobsmacked. So needless to say, I called my husband back and said, what has been going on? What have you not told me? And he shared that. He shared that with me. But yeah, for me, it was, to be honest, it wasn't really something I thought a huge amount about. As a Christian, my allegiance is to God above people, and so therefore I didn't feel that in good conscience I could then call him Your Holiness if I knew that that was going to then be offensive to God, because in his eyes that's not true. So yeah, that was kind of where that came from. But it's interesting, I think it's an interesting, I suppose, example of the way a Christian's life can look a little bit different. Because for me, being a Christian is actually not about things that you do or don't do. And I think often the perception is that being a Christian means you have to go to church, you have to read your Bible, you have to pray, you have to be nice, you have to be kind, you have to do this. And you can never do this, never do this, never do this, never do this. That is actually not at all about what being a Christian is. It's actually about having a personal relationship with God who made me and who made the world. And those things flow out of a Christian because we want to do what pleases God when we have a relationship with him and we realise the extraordinary lengths he's gone to make that possible for us. But it's not those things that make us a Christian. And I think the Dalai Lama episode probably is just a simple example of... A lot of people say, you know, she refused to call him Your Holiness. And in one sense, I did. But for me, it wasn't so much about this is the right thing to do, therefore I have to do it. It was actually, I have this personal relationship with God. The last thing I want to do is offend him. And that's where my allegiance is.
Well, I suppose you didn't even go to church for, what, 7 months or so?
No, you can't go to church when you're in MasterChef. So for me, being a Christian is not all about going to church. Obviously, now that I'm home, I choose to go to church because that's where I can learn more from the Bible. I can be with other Christians who will encourage me to keep living in a way that is pleasing to God. But that's not what makes me Christian. It's not about going to church. I still remain a Christian because I still had an ongoing relationship with God, and I do wherever I am. Often with this kind of travel, I miss church. Doesn't matter. Doesn't mean I'm any less of a Christian. Yeah.
Well, we'll get to your next dessert soon, but MasterChef did finish eventually.
The prison
sentence ended.
Yeah.
Your life changed a little bit?
Changed a lot. I remember, on the very first day of MasterChef, Gary standing in front of the whole 50 of us, and he said, "You have come to MasterChef to change your life." And I remember standing there in this crowd thinking, no, I didn't. I quite like my life. I just came to learn a bit more about cooking. So the funny thing is that now I'm on the other end and I think, oh, he was right. I really did change my life. It is rather different in lots of regards. So little things like I do a lot of travel now to do events like this or to do a lot of work is in major cities and I don't live in one, of course. I spend a lot of my time writing about food, testing food, eating food, it's fantastic, talking about food. And before I was a primary school teacher, which is a great job, but this is my passion. And so I feel extraordinarily privileged to be able to talk about the things that I'm passionate about, food, God in this case. So those things are very different. Some things haven't changed at all. Still have to clean the toilet. Still have to make the lunch boxes, you know? And I think as well that core in me is still the same. I'm still the same Christian person that I was when I went in. I've probably learnt to trust God a bit more because there were a few little hairy rides that was like, whoa, what is happening here? Mm. But, yeah, it's that thing that keeps me centred and keeps me, you know, life can happen around here. Let's face it, life is not always easy. Life, and just because you're a Christian, that doesn't change. Life can kind of all happen, but it's like I have sort of like, you know, a lifeline that it keeps me steady and things just...
So yeah. Now do you feel pressure with the lunch boxes? I don't know, consider the balance
section.
This is what my mum gave me, like this.
I tell you, the only time I feel pressure is when I'm in the supermarket and people come up and go, oh, what are you doing? Oh, stop it! No, the kids are pretty good. They're pretty flexible. They just eat what I give them and, yeah.
Right.
But, yes. Look,
I can handle that as well. That's right. I'll just get eating what I give.
And it's quite funny. A lot of people do say, oh, my goodness, your kids must love it. You eat like that every night. It's like, no, we don't. I'm now a working mum who's got 3 hours to spend on one dish of food. Nobody. No, we still do your ordinary, you know, some nights we have baked beans on toast. Kids love it. Yeah, it's a big mix. Sometimes I indulge and I play, and sometimes I just do, you know, sausages and mash.
Mm-hmm. So obviously you've become more of a high-profile figure now. You're well-known. You've got a book and so on. How have you dealt with the success that's come with being a tag of MasterChef winner?
Well, it's interesting. To be honest, I don't really think about it a huge amount because for me, life is just this journey. Things happen to you along the way. Sometimes they're good things, sometimes they're hard things. And for me, it's just keep on going. I've always been the kind of person that has wanted to just take opportunities that come. So if a door opens, I'm willing to walk through it. And I guess I look at this experience of MasterChef as like that. The door continues to be open, lots of different avenues that I can explore, and sometimes I try and explore too many at once, and I think, oh my goodness, I'm embracing. But, yeah, for me, success in life is actually not at all to do with the work or the money or the prestige. For me, success in life is, do I have that security about knowing who I am, knowing why I'm here, knowing that I'm known by God, intimately known, that He loves me. And that's where all my answers and my security about my future and security about my family come from, is because I have that relationship. And the rest, it will come and go. You know, the reality is MasterChef is not going to be around forever. This kind of hype is not going to be around forever. It will disappear. And I think that's the same in all cases with success. You know, even if you have a high-powered job that really, you know, drives you and you enjoy it and you love it, and, you know, there will come a time when it ends. and we can't hang all our hopes onto those things because they will move, they will change. And for me, it's about success in life is about finding that purpose to life, that want to change, that steady place.
Yeah. One final question before we get on to the strawberries. You titled your book The Sweet Life.
Yeah. Well, life is very sweet. It is a bit of a play on words. Obviously, it's all desserts, and so it is all about sweet food. But for me, I do feel incredibly privileged. I do see that my life is incredibly sweet. It doesn't mean that things don't go wrong. Things in the kitchen go wrong, things in life go wrong. But at the end of the day, I have an incredibly blessed life, and I'm thankful for it. And I just wanted to sort of, you know, tie that in somewhere with my book. I love desserts. I love my life. The whole lot is very, very sweet. So that's why I call it The Sweet Life.
That's beautiful. How sweet it is. That's the title of that. Now, would you have some time for maybe some questions and so on? And you're happy to take questions on?
Absolutely. Feel free to ask me about, you know, cooking things. I don't promise to answer all of them. Cooking things, things about MasterChef, things about my faith, things about life. Definitely don't promise to answer all those. But anyway, if you have a question, I'm more than happy to answer it for you.
What support is given to the participants when they leave? Because you said they're in a bubble.
Yes.
I think sometimes there's an over-inflated sense of self when they go out and
yeah.
down.
Yes.
Is there support given from...
Yeah, look, there is a fair bit of support. It's hard for me to talk from direct experience because my experience was probably quite different to everybody else's. So when I left, I was given an agent that was part of the contract. And so she helped me navigate through all of that, which was great. For most of them, though, the production crew do remain. So there is within the production team, we had a house coordinator who looked after us in the house. Well, we actually had two. They were on a roster system. But there was also a contestant coordinator who basically just looked after our well-being. So she was the one. She got to know Luke very well because she was the one that would ring him up every so often and say, every couple of weeks, and say, "All right, we've got free time on this day from these hours. Do you want to come down?" And she would liaise and work that out all that out with him. Or if he needed to get a message to me, something to do with the kids, he would be able to send it. He would be able to phone her directly, and she would get the message to me. And then sometimes I would phone them. So she remained pretty critical, I think, for people when they first left. So she was their point of contact. That being said, the executive producer of the whole show, so she's sort of, you know, your top dog, she's responsible for creating the whole thing, is such a lovely person, so incredibly caring of people, that she often still phones me. I got a phone call from her the other day, just checking in with different things or asking different things. So I have an ongoing relationship with her. I'm not sure that every contestant would, but... if she knew that somebody was going to struggle going home, generally people who struggle with the process also struggle with going home, it would not have surprised me at all if she phoned them to see if they were okay. And in fact, we had an incident, which you probably may remember if you saw it, of somebody in our group who brought in a phone, which was against the rules. Now, unfortunately, I think a lot of people talked about it in terms of he was cheating. My personal opinion is that I don't think he was cheating at all. He had a lot going on in his life outside. His mum had disappeared when he was 16, and it had then been the 7 years, and so she was declared dead while he was in there, so he had that going on. His girlfriend's father had a heart attack and ended up in ICU on life support, so he had that going on, and I suspect that that's why he brought the phone in. The sadness for me is that I think that if he had said to the production team, "I need more phone calls," because I had that experience. I had to do, my sister separated from her husband while I was in there, and I went to them and I said, "I need to call her once a week just to check that she's okay," and they said, "That's fine." And I'm sure they would have done that for him as well. But I think he felt very much like he needed to be able to be in contact with them. And I get that, you know. I think if he'd spoken up about it, he probably would have been given that contact. So... When they dealt with that, though, I think they dealt with it very carefully. And she, that executive producer, dealt with him so beautifully afterwards. And they helped him deal with the media, and they helped him. So while I can't say I've sat down with each contestant and said, "Were they all good for you?" My assumption is that there was support there. And look, the reality is, too, is I think you also have to take responsibility for your own perspective on it. You know, you go in. At the end of the day, it's reality TV. It ends. You know, it's not... doesn't make you a different person. You're just the same person. And so you have to work out how you slot back into life. It was quite funny, actually, my husband, because he's a very ordered, organised person. And so when I was away, he had a three-month schedule up on the wall, every day listed out, where each kid needed to go when, what they were having for dinner. He planned it 3 months in advance. It was the same cycle over and over, but anyway, that's okay.
Bacon's on toast.
Yeah. Pizza, bacon's on toast, hamburgers, takeaway. No, he was very good. He did really well. But it was quite funny because it was funny though, he only planned it to April because he thought, no, I should be done after April. Yeah, anyway, I got home in August. So I got home though on this production break and saw this up on the wall and I said to him, I don't know where I fit. And he said, you don't. That's the whole point of it. And for us, there was a bit of an adjustment because after 7 months, he'd worked out his routines. This is the way it worked. This is when he did the washing. This is when he took the kids to school. This is how we did lunchboxes. And I actually had to say, okay, I've got to work out how to navigate my way back into this family life. There were little things like the first week I was home, I started cooking dinners to give him a break. You know, obviously he's done it for 7 months, so I can do the shopping and the dinners. And I remember on Friday night I cooked a beautiful dinner, I had no idea what it was. Kids all came home and said, where's the pizza? Friday night pizza night. So they started these little traditions. I'm like, oh, I didn't know, I'm sorry. So every Friday night now we have to make pizzas.
So you had that by yourself.
Yeah. So there is an adjustment phase, and I'm sure everybody has that. And it's probably harder for the people who've been in there longer because it's a very surreal world. And like when I was recipe testing for my cookbook, you know, I'm used to cooking with the MasterChef pantry. You know, my husband comes home and he says, you do realise our food budget's not quite the same as MasterChef's. You know, there's lots of adjustments. You get used to just being able to open new packets of things and use them, and you come home and you think, hang on a second, now they're going to buy another one. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
What sort of opportunities have you given your race to speak about the secular opportunities and the spiritual opportunities, the experience? And then how do you see that now?
Look, I see everything melding it together. For me, my secular life and my Christian life are the one life. I don't separate them. So who I am when I went in is exactly the same person as who I am now. So I live my life very open. I reasoned very early on with myself. It's reality TV. I'm just going to be who I am. Some people will like it. Some people won't. That's okay because that's life. That's what happens everywhere. So for me, there's never the segregation. It's I just live my life.
What opportunity do you feel it's created for you?
Oh, look, there's been so many doors open for so many different opportunities, both in terms of my faith as well as in terms of, work life and family life and lots and lots of different things. Yeah, huge opportunities. I never dreamed. I mean, we're 2 years on. I would have thought it all would have been dead and buried by now, but it's not. Life keeps going on. I've just had incredible opportunities. Yeah. Yes.
Not a biblical question.
That's fine.
MasterChef, I find the show, the people, the contestants are very emotional.
Yes.
They cry, they tear. Are they being encouraged by producers?
No. It's very hard to fathom what happens on TV. It looks to you as a viewer that we wake up, that we go in, we cook for a couple of hours and we go home. The reality is that we're woken at 5 in the morning and we film in the house for a few hours because they have to film everybody doing separate things, doing all their things, so they don't know whose story is going to play out in the kitchen that day. So there's a couple of hours of filming. You then get to set. Look, the reality is that the cooking time is the cooking time. If they say you've got 90 minutes, you've got 90 minutes. You haven't got any more or any less. But everything outside of that is open for retakes because they want you as a viewer to feel like you're in the room there with us. So they have to shoot from this angle and this angle and this angle and this angle, you know. And so the day is incredibly long. And there's a common saying in television of hurry up and wait. As in, hurry up, we need you here on set right now. You get there and then it's like, okay, now just hold still for half an hour. Oh, okay, so we wait. All right, we're ready to go. Okay, we talk, and then now we've just got to wait for another 20 minutes. Now, it's because they're making creative decisions about how things look, making sure they've got the shots that they need. And so there's a lot of discussion happening in a room we don't see But for us as contestants, we're just waiting, 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 waiting. So it's a very, very long and boring. In fact, if you ask my kids, would you like to be on television when you're older, all three would say, oh no, it's so boring. Because they've been on set now 3 days, and it is long and tedious. Most of our days we finished filming at about 6 at night, and then if we had needed to film in the house at home, we would then come home and do that on top. So the days are from 5 a.m. through to about 9 or 10, a lot of the days. So very, very long days. And so that wears you down over time. Some parts of it are incredibly tedious. And so what happens is people are not necessarily getting sleep or not necessarily getting exercise that they need. Or do you know what I mean? And so gradually over time, people are just, oh, I've had enough of this. And I think it comes out in the challenge or in the interview or that kind of thing. It is incredible. And also you've got to remember as well, everybody's away from their family, away from their loved ones. They're in this very unreal, really, situation. And it does sort of make you on edge a little bit. So it's a difficult process, and I actually do think MasterChef is not just about the cooking in terms of the competition. It's actually about dealing with that process of TV as well. There are some people I think early on end up going home quite quickly. I think it shows in their cooking, but it's because it's hard to deal with. It is a very surreal sort of place to be. Yeah. Yeah.
What's your relationship?
No, look, my relationship with God, the way I see it is my life has been a journey with God. So as a child, I actually grew up in a Christian family. So I grew up learning the stories of the Bible. But in my early 20s, I realised I actually didn't know how any of those stories fitted together. I just had heard them and I knew them. And I actually didn't really live as a Christian for a few years. I just stopped caring, just ignored God, really. I didn't feel like I needed him there. I knew he was there, but didn't really need him. And then what happened in my early 20s was I actually started to wonder. I started to think through those big questions of life. Why am I here? What is the point of this life? What happens when it all ends? But I didn't want to assume that the God I'd grown up with was the only answer. So I actually went researching. I actually read so many books. I talked to so many people about what they believed, about what they thought about the world, their philosophy. And I really critiqued everything that I heard. And what I ended coming away with was that the God of the Bible, the one I'd been taught those stories about, was a God who just desperately wanted a relationship with me and was willing to go to extraordinary lengths to make that happen. And every other religion and every other thought process that I had come across was actually about what you had to do to make yourself right to a God, or what you had to do to get yourself to that perfect place, or what you had to do to make life comfortable. And I found it incredibly freeing and liberating that there was a relationship I could have there, but it actually wasn't about me, it was about what he had done. And so that was when my journey as a Christian began, and I think it continues. And so I grew through that time, and as Christians you have times where everything seems to sort of fit into place, and other times where you have lots of questions and you're trying to wrestle with it. And I don't pretend to have all the answers as a Christian. I don't think any Christian does. But I think what Christians do have is a relationship and a trust in God, knowing that he loves us, that he forgives us, that he teaches us, and that he helps us. And really, for me, I won't ever have full, perfect understanding until heaven. Yeah, MasterChef is just one little slice out of that big journey.
There's another question.
Yeah.
Kate, you clearly like to do research. In the MasterChef house, if you don't have access to magazines or internet or
television, how do you do that? Well, most of us brought in suitcases of books, cookbooks. And I was really fortunate in our season, because we were a group that just, we got on very well, particularly once we sort of got about halfway through. We just gelled so much as a group, and you talk about it. You learn about food from other people because, you know, somebody else on the, one of the other contestants might have a real passion for Spanish food. And I go, I'm going to watch them, I'm going to talk to them. They're interested in it, they're passionate about it, they're going to talk about it. So you learn things and you try things. But a lot of cookbook reading, like I read cookbooks every night going to bed, not so much because I wanted to study. I was just so loving it. I just couldn't get enough, and I still do. I often read big food nerd. I could read cookbooks going to bed. Or there's some great books out there as well on food science. So there's one that's, I love the title, What Einstein Taught His Cook. So it's the science of food, but at a real basic level for those of us who are not scientists. Heston Blumenthal writes a book called The Search for Perfection. It's like a novel, it's thick. And he goes through all the basic dishes found in Britain, and he researches where to get the best produce, like where to source the best ingredient, and then what is the best technique, scientifically as well as, you know, every other way. And you know, read through it, and you just learn something. I love it. I find cooking is one of those things that I will always keep learning. There's always more to learn. And you learn it from people, you learn it from books. Now that I'm home, yes, I have access to the internet, it's great. But the sad thing is that now I tend to just go and think, okay, I need a recipe for this, click onto it, yeah, okay, I can change that. I'm not thinking as much of myself. I'm actually relying on what other people do a lot. And then I just recently I've tried to take a step back and go, no, how would I do this? Luke actually was away, bought me a flavour thesaurus. So it talks through, I know it sounds like a daggy present, but I love it. But it talks through flavour combinations and which ones work really well and why, which ones don't. And I love flicking through there and go, that, I would never have thought that those two go together. And I'll play around in the kitchen and go, yes, that's good. But dark chocolate and rosemary is one of the most beautiful flavour combinations, which I only discovered about, yeah, through MasterChef. You know, it just comes, and things feed each other, I find. Yeah. It's the same with any kind of passion you have in life.
No one really wants to have any of this today. Yeah. one more question, yeah.
Will MasterChef judges be the same as
MasterChef? Look, I think they are, although you probably see more of the judge and we still see more of the whole person. So they definitely have that judge persona on when they're critiquing our food, but to be honest, I want that. Like, I knew that those dishes I put up were not perfect. There was always ways that they could be improved. And I want to hear their opinion on it because they know what they're doing. They know what they're talking about. But at the same time, they were incredibly supportive of us and wanted us to grow and to learn. And because most chefs, particularly chefs who've been at the top of their game, they've trained countless apprentices. And part of the reason that they get to the top is because they're good at training their team. And so their team then supports them. So these guys are very good at training younger chefs. So, I mean, a vivid memory I have is somebody put forward a dish and it tasted fantastic, but it just looked wrong. And I remember George, after all the cameras had gone off, he grabbed a plate and he said, come around here. We all gathered around and he grabbed these little elements off the plate, replated the whole thing, and it looked spectacular. We all went, wow. And he pushed it forward to that person. He said, well, you cooked it. You know, like he wanted us to think through, you know, and have confidence. Actually, we can do this. We just need to think it through and think differently and think outside the box. So stretching us all the time. Matt Preston is incredibly caring and genuine. He's the perfect host. We did a couple of reward lunches where he came along and we always wanted him to be there because he engaged everybody in conversation with the chef. He was a real gift with words and with encouragement. And I mean, when I first won, he came over straight away and said, here's my phone number, call me anytime you like, if you need anything, if you need any help. Just so, you know, it wasn't us and them towards the end. They really were like friends. And then we went back to film All Stars, and that was even more just like friends. Like, it was just everyone getting together, like work colleagues getting together, like, okay, we're going to make a television, let's do it, you know. So, yeah, I think they were, you saw the judge side, but there is definitely a human side as well. A lovely, warm. Gary was the dad.
Please,
dad jokes.
Yeah. Please, thank you, Kate. Again.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.